Exodus 13:17 through 13:22, and the use of big numbers in the Old Testament. The 15th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on November 24, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Concerned last week because I didn't get around to talking about big numbers.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start out talking about big numbers, and then we'll get back into Exodus. First of all, I was teaching elsewhere, and I made an offhand comment about questioning one of the big numbers in the Old Testament, and got myself into a real mess. So let me explain, first of all, why this topic would even be interesting to me. Why would I even be concerned about the accuracy of the big numbers in our Old Testament text? First of all, let me assure you, I believe in the inerrancy of the Bible. I believe that it's inerrant in all of its details, as well as in matters of theology. But my belief in inerrancy is in the inerrancy of the manuscripts as they were originally penned. They were penned a long time ago. And back then they did not have printers. Manuscripts were copied by hand. And so the manuscripts that our Bible, this Bible, is based on are copies of copies of copies of copies of copies. A lot of those manuscripts exist, some of them older than others, but we know even from comparing the ones that exist that there are differences. So there is some question as to what was actually in the original manuscript. Now, I think that we are very fortunate, and it is a credit to those who have gone before us, that the kinds of discrepancies that exist in the manuscripts that we have are relatively minor. Many people have made the point that there is no significant theological doctrine that hinges on disagreements between manuscripts. Most of the discrepancies are very minor. One of the places that it is easiest to have discrepancies is with respect to numbers. About 15 years ago, I began collecting copies of this chain letter. It's a chain letter that starts out saying, this has been sent to you for good luck. And then it goes on using religious language to say, you must have faith and I don't remember all the rest of it, but then it talks about what you have to do is make 20 copies of this letter and send it out to 20 friends within 9 days, and God will bless you. And it gives several examples of things that happen, and people who did send it out and the wonderful things that happened to them, and people who didn't send it out and the bad things that happened to them. Well, this thing has been circulating for at least 15 years around the world. And every once in a while, someone will... if you ever receive one, I would love a copy. I'm still collecting them. My latest one was in email form. Some of the early ones were bad photocopies. And before that, they were hand copied. So, but it's very interesting to compare them. The reason I'm collecting them is because it's kind of a study in in textual criticism. That is the study of how you determine from all these different versions what the original must have said. That's my interest. You don't have to look at them very long to see that the most common discrepancies are in numbers. Numbers, and the second most common is names. And I have thought about that, and it's becoming apparent to me why that would be the case. Because if a word is wrong, if you copy a word incorrectly, the next person will probably be able to figure out the mistake. If you just misspell it, if it's grammatically incorrect, you can't just put any combination of letters in the slot for a word and make it work. There are only certain things that are possible. The meaning has to fit, it has to fit grammatically. So there's a sense in which language is self-correcting. Think about numbers. Unless there's more context where you're adding up numbers or something like that, any number will do. If it's messed up, the next person will have no clue that it's messed up. So it makes sense that numbers would be the most easily corrupted in a text. There are problems with the numbers in the Old Testament. And the problems are of two different kinds. They seem to be. If we look at parallel accounts in Kings and in Chronicles, accounts which are talking about the same thing, there are instances where the numbers disagree. It seems clearer that there has been some textual corruption there. Now, the fellow that... There's an article that I found written by John William Wenham. Is he the same guy that did the Hebrew? There's a Hebrew grammar by a Wenham, isn't there? Okay.
Maybe, though, there's a very good book on the inerrancy of the Bible that talks about, it's called Jesus and the Bible. Mm-hmm. It talks about Jesus teaching on the authority of Scripture and stuff, by a guy named John.
Okay. He gave a lecture at the Tyndale House in Cambridge. This is in 67, and then a manuscript of that was printed, and that's what I read it this summer, and that's what my comments will be based upon. He makes the observation that in the early part of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch and then the historical books, Kings and Chronicles, the kinds of discrepancies seem to be in magnitudes of 10. So it'll be 5,000 in one account and 50,000 in another account, or 5,000 in one count and 500,000 in another account. But that's the most common. As we get into Ezra and Nehemiah, the discrepancies tend to be in discrepancies of one or two. So it'll say 531 in one account, and it'll say 532 in another account. But in general, especially in the early part of the Old Testament, the most common thing that we see is unreasonably high numbers, unreasonably large numbers. Now, the number that is particularly interesting to us in looking at Exodus is the number in Exodus 12:37, where it gives us the number of men, that Israelite men that were leaving Egypt, and it gives the number as 600,000. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. So that's 600,000 men. Typically what they do then is to multiply that times 4 to determine the total population. So 2,400,000 would have been the total number leaving Egypt. Now that's a huge number, especially when compared with comments that are made elsewhere in Exodus. For instance, all the baby boys born to the Israelites were to be thrown into the Nile River. That's a lot of babies to be thrown into the Nile River. Another one, only two midwives. This is his comment. I'm not sure that the text indicates that there were only two midwives, but that's one of his other concerns. As they're going through the desert, could there possibly have been enough water for 2,400,000 people? It says that the whole congregation of Israel was to gather at Mount Sinai for Moses to address them. It indicates that Moses judged the whole people for a period of time until it got to be too many, and then he had to delegate that authority. But presumably he was able to judge over 2,400,000 people for some time. In Canaanite, it says that the Israelites were anticipated by seven nations greater and mightier than them. Okay, so Wenham says, if you look at all the evidence that we see in Exodus, that number is too large. 2 million is too many. Between 2 and 3 million people is too many. It doesn't work. Oh, another one he points out that I just remembered, he didn't put it, I didn't list it here, but it says that the Egyptians sent their 600 best chariots and then some additional chariots after these people. If there were almost 3 million of them, it's hard to believe that they would have been cowered in fear. Wenham says, if you look at the text, it's pretty clear that these are not errors that were done intentionally. And he uses the example, you would not say that 16,000 passengers were killed in a bus wreck. It's too many. So it's obviously not an intentional error. It's an error that has crept in, and people have faithfully kept it, even though it didn't fit in the context. Okay, how does he resolve this? Following on the work of others, he points out that the word for 1,000, which is elef, is spelled, well, in Hebrew, words were originally spelled just using the consonants, not the vowels. And the word for 1,000 is elef. There is another related word that would have different vowels but would be spelled with the same consonants, and that's, I think, aleph with an a, which means captain. Captain, originally it was apparently a captain of a division of men that consisted of 1,000 men. So, it can mean 1,000, or it can mean the commander of 1,000. Later, it came to mean just a commander with an unspecified number. There are various numbers that could be under him. It can also mean a family or a clan, and it's clearly used that way in Judges 6:15. In other instances, it is used hyperbolically not to mean a specific number, but to just mean many, as with our word myriad. Myriad literally means 10,000, but we use it to refer to things that are far fewer than 10,000. It's just used as a, just to mean a lot. Okay, he then went through and correlated the census that we have in Numbers, chapters 1 and 2, and then also in chapter 26, where it enumerates how many people were in each tribe of Israel as they went into the promised land. And on the basis of that, and unfortunately in his article, it refers to further details on page 36, but the article ends on page 35. So I suspect that there is a longer manuscript, and that's hinted at early on. There's a longer manuscript that existed, and this, I think, is a shortened version of that. So we don't have all of his details. But what he reasons is that Eleph, as we see it in Exodus 12, 37, refers to commanders rather than thousands. So when it says there were 600,000 fighting men, he takes that to mean, let me read this once more. I want to make sure I get this. It says 600,000 men on foot. He takes that to mean 600 infantry captains. 600 captains of the infantry. And he cites evidence for why he feels justified in seeing that as foot soldiers. And he speculates that there were Israelites that served in the Egyptian army. There is certainly extra-biblical evidence that would say that Moses was a commander in the Egyptian military. And he points to other evidence that seems to suggest that some of the Israelites fought in the Egyptian army. Please remember that Pharaoh was concerned about the growth of the Israelites and saw them as a military threat. If they would go over to the other side, it would potentially be a military problem. So presumably they did have some soldiers among them. And then he calculates that on the basis of the numbers that he sees in the book of Numbers that there were probably about 2 officers per 100. And each 100 by this time had about 75 men in it. The hundreds is a term kind of like division. Originally apparently it had 100, but over time they modified their tactics and strategies, and those they would have fewer people in them than 100. So he estimates a fighting force on the basis if there were 600 officers with 2 officers per 100 and 75 soldiers in each unit, the total fighting force would have been about 18,000. Then if you multiply that by 4 to get the total population, it turns out to be about 72,000 people total. Now, I don't know that his particular line of reasoning is compelling. I think one would have to look at the details more closely to see why he feels justified in making the decisions that he makes. However, I think that his general approach, that is, looking into the possibility that Eleph could mean something other than strictly 1,000, I think that that's probably right. And to see those as captains or officers does not seem unreasonable to me. Whatever, it seems to me that it's important for us to keep in mind the possibility that the numbers as we see them here are not as they appear. They may not have been as they appear to us in the text. We need to be intelligent about the way that we look at these numbers and interpret the Old Testament. Comments or questions on that?
Mm-hmm. In the census of the numbers, they're using males over 20 years old.
Right.
Those numbers are fairly large too from each tribe. Everyone's averaging around 50 to 70,000 of and 12 tribes.
Right. He deals with that as well.
But it seems almost larger than the 600,000. Yeah. Well, if you have an average over.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't remember how he deals with that, but he does deal with that.
That's more of a that's more from a census style description of who was populating the land.
Right.
Than an offhand comment of this is how many people.
That's right. That's right. So you're saying that would appear to be more reliable.
Well,
there it has totals. You have numbers and then it totals and it needs to total up. And he talks about that, but I don't remember what he says about that. and you could look at this. But I think what he ends up doing with that is again talking about in terms of divisions, military units, and that although a group of men that is called 1,000, I think he argues that this time was not actually 1,000, and the hundreds were not actually 100. Yes, Kevin.
In the corresponding reference 32, Exodus 38:26, it says, "For each one who passed over those who were numbered from 20 years old and upwards, 603,550 men." Is that written? Is the Hebrew there the same? Even though it goes, it's a more finite number.
Yeah, I don't know. He doesn't mention, Wenham doesn't mention that and doesn't deal with that. Yeah, that's a much more specific number. And here we have, in this he has, let's see. Here we have each person bringing a half shekel. And then it gives us a total of the number of talents and shekels that the whole group brought. So presumably you would be able to cross-check that and figure out if the total census fits with the number of shekels that were collected. That kind of context, it should be safer.
Unless in the transcribing that they purposely intended to have consistencies from.
Right. He argues that he thinks that there are instances where some of the numbers were changed to make it add up. Yes, Bob.
Assuming that Wenham's theory is correct, there's lots of large numbers throughout the Bible. How do you, based on that, how do you decide when the number is accurate and when it's not? You just have to look at each individual.
How do I decide?
Yeah, I mean, assuming that, I mean, it sounds like you are in agreement with his ideas. So that means when you read your Bible, that must be an option for you when you read a number. Oh, this, you know, this may or may not be right.
Right.
How do you decide?
I am sympathetic with his. With some of the observations that he makes that seem to indicate that a number between 2 and 3 million is too large. That even within the text itself, there seem to be indications that there were not that many. And so that it's in instances like that that I am willing to entertain the possibility that the number is corrupted. But it is not a big deal to me. If it was 600,000, then it was 600,000. It's not troubling to me that it would be 600,000 particularly. It's just hard to understand then by what means did God provide the water? Was it miraculously provided the whole time? Did the river flows, were they miraculously kept from having the kinds of water demands that we have? That becomes, I mean, that's difficult to sort out, but if it was 600,000, then God took care of them. I mean, they had what they needed. Yes, Logan.
What language were the Israelites or ex-Egyptians using?
Well, presumably it was Hebrew. Presumably it was Hebrew.
So sometimes they might write these numbers in words, and sometimes they might write these numbers in numbers.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. Wenham is assuming that in the manuscripts they were written in, I don't know, certainly parts of them were written in words. His argument requires that, I think. But I don't know the answer to that. when he talks about Ezra and Nehemiah, where they're off by one or two consistently, the dominant language at that time was Aramaic, and in the Aramaic numerical system, it was a chit kind of system, the slashes, and so he theorizes that the mistakes there were crept in when people miscounted in what they were copying and then put down the wrong number of chits at the end. So it's off by one or two. But they're off by tens and hundreds in the earlier part of the Old Testament. So it sounds like there we've got a mistake of misunderstanding of units that are being used, tens of units.
Because they disagree between different counts.
Right. Right.
It's interesting that we look out at the landscape and say, well, this landscape couldn't support these people, so there's a family. Instead of just going directly to the book saying, well, we have a disagreement with the counts, how do we reconcile that?
Well, it's only in Kings and Chronicles we have different disagreements between accounts. As we look at Exodus, we don't have a parallel account. So there he's looking at the whole context and he's saying, well, does this number fit the context? We don't have something to cross-check it with.
Have you seen any from Rwanda lately? They showed the road with about 600,000 refugees on it. I mean, it's just nuts.
Yeah.
It's like ants on the move. It's shoulder to shoulder for miles. Miles. There's 10 miles. I just can't imagine. Unless you moved those people in groups of, say, hundreds or 500s or whatever. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. That anyone could ever accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
The second chapter of Numbers kind of does that adding up of the tribes.
Right.
And it comes out to 603,550. So whatever error occurred in the sum would have to occur. So it would have to be, a multiplication by 10,
yeah,
or something like that. And it would have to be consistent through the use of all those numbers. I don't know Hebrew enough to know whether there's a numerical system as in addition to a word. It would have to be consistent.
I know in the Hebrew grammar books, they teach a numerical system where there are letters that stand for a certain number. But apparently it's unclear how old that system was and what kind of system would have been used in the original manuscript.
Do you assume that possibly some of the references to human age are similarly corrupted then? I mean, are there...
In Genesis?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have wondered if it could be the case that we have somehow lost our knowledge of what some of those symbols actually stood for, what number some of the symbols that were used stood for, and that that's what causes the long, really long lifespans. However, it seems to me that my understanding of the account of early Genesis, if my understanding is correct, it demands that there be longer lifespans before the flood. And it is consistent throughout the ancient Near East in the king's lists that go way back to the beginning of time, that the kings had very long lifespans. Some of them like up into 20,000 years and that sort of thing. Absolutely enormous numbers, much bigger than what we have in Genesis. And that those decrease over time. So my inclination is to take the numbers that we have for their ages to be correct at this point. I don't see any extremely compelling reason to see it otherwise, other than our experience.
Yeah. It's just that we could be accused of saying, well, in these cases, the very large numbers are sort of support
right. or theology.
Right.
And in other cases, they don't.
No, it's not theology, though. What I would see as being different is that in the people with long lifespans in early Genesis, they precede an event that I think the Bible is indicating was an earth-changing event. And after that, then, the lifespans begin to be more like what we experience. They are not out of reason from what we experience. And so there, I think we have, in the text, reason to think that we should imagine the environment differently before the flood from what it is now. And in Exodus, I don't know that we have reason to expect that the conditions in Sinai were significantly different then than they are now. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm just speculating, and but I want to keep in mind the fact that these manuscripts have been passed down. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that there are corruptions in these numbers. And I don't think that there's any major theological issue that is involved in these. Yes, Margaret.
This is probably the time to answer it, but just indicate that I'm interested in hearing about it. Kevin kind of hinted at whenever we talk about stuff like this, if we all agree that Scripture is inerrant, that kind of limits our discussion to, you know, certain explanations like scribal errors and that kind of thing. But a lot of people who aren't sympathetic to the idea that Scripture is inerrant would point to either we can't trust the Bible because we can't trust the text, which I think there are good answers for, or we can't trust the Bible because it's just absurd to believe that anything produced by man could be inerrant in its entirety. And of all the the challenges to Christianity that ever come up, the one I'm least comfortable with is the inerrancy. Every time I hear somebody make a defense for inerrancy, it makes a lot of sense to me, but trying to reproduce this for me to try to reproduce it is a more difficult thing. And I'd be interested at some point, I don't know if other people would be interested or if this would be the proper forum, but I'd definitely be interested in a real complete defense of the idea of inerrancy. Because I know some people hearing you say this would say, well, you know, why don't you just take it all the way? You can't trust these numbers. We really don't know what's true and what's not true for various reasons, and why do you therefore trust them?
Just, this is not a full-blown defense, but just very... My thinking about that, the way I approach it, is my belief in inerrancy is not based on going through the Bible and finding no errors. My belief in inerrancy is very simply based on the fact that when I read it, it explains reality so well. It explains reality so well that I can't imagine it having a... derived from human authority. And on the basis of the Bible, I come to have faith in... I mean, just... Other people have made the same argument, but it makes a lot of sense to me that I look at the Bible as just a historical source, starting with a reasonably good historical source that tells me about the person Jesus Christ. And as I read about the person Jesus Christ, I become convinced that, in fact, he is what he claimed to be, that is, the Son of God. And as the Son of God, he demonstrates, he exemplifies one who grants to the Bible complete authority. and assumes it to be inerrant. And so ultimately, my belief in inerrancy is just accepting Jesus' word for it.
So you're really not defining inerrancy, but your valid dating trust that it's reality. Because you're not, just because Jesus defended inerrancy, you still don't give any type of description of what he meant by that, other than it was some kind of reality, something worthy that we can put our trust in, that defines, defines truth. See, these are all terms that are just the content that's all over.
Well, Jesus talks about the, where's this argument where he talks about the jot and the tittle?
Uh-huh.
And what is it he's talking about? Nothing will pass from
the law. To abolish the law, I have come to abolish or to fulfill.
Matthew 5. Well, I would have to refresh my memory on there are a couple of instances where Jesus refers to the Old Testament, and his argument depends on the Old Testament being accurate, that word for word it is correct. That's the kind of authority he seems to be granting to the Old Testament. If that's the case, then if he is assuming that the Old Testament is accurate down to its small details, then if I'm convinced he's the Son of God, I have to grant that same kind of authority.
Yeah, and then you get back to the problem you started out this conversation with, is what is the job to do?
Right, the possibility. Well, yeah, one could get there. I think we'd have to look at Jesus' arguments again, but I think that one has to conclude that he's assuming that the Old Testament is true, is entirely true. That every assertion that it makes is true, even in small details. But we do have the other problem of that may have been true for the manuscripts, but what then does that say about the existing documents that we have?
Documents which were not the originals as well. So if he's conferring authority upon the versions that were in circulation at his time, then he's saying something about inerrancy, which is much more than that they were inerrant in the original documents. He's saying that God supervised the transmission of that information. And consequently, the same sort of problem exists for us to make the decision as to whether we're going to, and I don't know the answer to this, but whether we're going to take the position that the inerrancy exists in the original documents, but not in any of the transmitted ones. In which case, you could say that Jesus talking about the jots and the tittles in itself was apocryphal and wasn't part of the original document. Right. And you can dismiss anything.
Right.
So, you know, like Margaret, I'm kind of interested in what that would really mean. It seems like for the doctrine of inerrancy to be valuable, it requires some sort of divine supervision of the transmission as well. Although it's obvious that amongst the manuscripts, as you have said, there are differences.
Right. So. I think that's what, and when you, I think one could even argue that Jesus was recognizing the fact that different copies that have come down disagree, and therefore he can't be arguing, or he wouldn't have been arguing, that every copy is inerrant. because they're contradictory. Their discrepancies are such.
When I did a study on that, the jot, I thought, referred to the sort of a variation on the word iota or yod, the smallest letter in both Greek and Hebrew alphabets. And tittle is like a serif, a little curlicue on the letter. So I suspect he's speaking metaphorically in every little detail that the scriptural author intended to convey. Whatever he intended to convey in its entirety is correct.
Right.
This is the topic that we've been talking about in the second hour of the Tuesday night classes at the Study Center. If people are interested in the question of what did Jesus have to say about the authority of the Scriptures, I gathered together a kind of a list of places where Jesus and the Apostles talk about their view of the authority of the Scripture or the authority of their own teaching, and kind of put all that together. So I have a copy of that if anyone's interested.
Great. Anything else? Let's make a little bit of progress in Exodus 13. The Passover has been completed. The Passover meal has been completed. And they take off. Apparently during the night, they take off and head out. Verses 17 through 21. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night, in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. So they take off. It must have been a wild departure. They're leaving in haste. They're just taking the belongings that are at hand that could easily be rounded up. They have asked their masters for spare jewelry and that sort of thing, and they plundered them as God said that they would. And they take off. But they take with them the bones of Joseph, remembering what Joseph had made his descendants swear to him, that he would that they would take his bones back to the land of Canaan, back to Palestine. Joseph was trusting in the promises that God had made, that they would be returned to the land that God had given to Abraham, that they would go back there to possess it for their own. Abraham, when he had lived there, he didn't really possess it. He wasn't really able to control it and make it his own. He didn't have enough people. But now they're going back to possess it, for it to be their own. And Joseph knew that that would happen. He was trusting that that would happen on the basis of God's promises. Joseph knew that Egypt was not his home, and he wanted his bones taken to his real home, which was elsewhere. That was the home that was promised to him. They take off by the road. It says the road through the Philistine country. There were apparently three routes out of Egypt that would lead to Palestine. One was right along the coast. That was the route that was generally taken by the Egyptians when they went to Palestine to do their raiding, their expeditions up through Palestine. That one was heavily fortified. And apparently that one was not even considered. That was not, the Israelites were not going to go that way. They weren't even going to attempt to go that way, begin to go that way. And then it says, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, a route that would have been a little bit further south through the Sinai, that would have led them right up into the Shephelah of Palestine. That was inhabited by Philistines, that area of Israel. And God decided that he would not take them that way because if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. There's a sense in which God is being very gentle with them as well as incremental with them. That he knows what they are ready for and he knows what they are not ready for. And he will expose them to the dangers that he has prepared them for, but he is not going to expose them to the dangers that they are not prepared for. Much like as parents, you face that constant dilemma of wanting to expand the kinds of things that you expose your children to, but not too quickly, because there are some things that they are clearly not ready for. Logan?
Yes. Deliver them from the greatest army in the world. He just killed the firstborn of everybody in that congregation. But he's not going to take them through this rough neighborhood. It makes sense.
It doesn't make sense? It certainly rings true in my experience. It's not that certainly God could deliver them from the Philistines. The thing is, in their own experience, coming to see that that's true, to really believe that that's true.
And they weren't fighting the Egyptians. It wasn't a battle formation.
That's right.
It was something different. They were in both head-on and middle-on. You guys get a whole other experience from the
Egyptians. Anybody can share it with them. They had to fight some battles. I mean, they had to invest, take risk, and own it. But they never had to doubt the outcome.
But if they went up the coastal route instead of through the wilderness, God would never have the chance to part the Red Sea.
Yeah, good point.
Oh, there you go.
One thing that's striking about this, the Exodus part of it, is the Israelites are essentially spectators. As time goes on, they become participants. As they go into the Promised Land, for instance, they become more participants in it. But at this early stage, they are just spectators to it. And God is preparing them to be participants, but he's preparing them in an incremental process. When they first arrive to the south of Palestine, God says, go up into the land and take it. And their response is, no. They're big. They're big dudes. We aren't going. So God said, oh, 40 more years ought to do it. Yeah.
What I find curious is that God says he doesn't want to take them there lest the people change their minds when they see war. And it seems strange because they changed their minds a lot. You know, they kept saying, well, let's go back. And also, it seems that God is in control of their thoughts, their minds. I mean, the way that's phrased there, it sounds like God's, you know, sort of got to
justice plan.
Yeah, figure out this plan so they don't get away from it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we need to see it a little differently, and that is, it is not God's way of operating to reach into their minds and tweak them, adjust them, just now they'll be fully faithful to me. But rather the way he does it is through a process of having them experience greater and greater difficulties and see God come through. It's through those means that God changes the way that they see the world, rather than just flipping a switch in there.
On the other hand, in the next chapter, we'll talk about God hardening Pharaoh's heart and all of the Egyptians' hearts, so that all of a sudden that they kind of come to their senses and say, you know, what have we done? We let these people go. And it almost appears as though, God did that very thing, went into them and said, okay, go after them.
Well, even though he changes the minds of the Israelites through this incremental process, through experiences, that doesn't mean that it wasn't God that did it. But rather, it's through means that we see all the time around us. How do people change? Typically, they change over time through difficult circumstances where they reevaluate, reassess, rather than just a different person. So the way that God does it is through these incremental processes, through a lot of pain and struggle, and that's what he's going to do with them. He's not ready to expose them, to have them physically fight the Philistines. He's got a lot more work to do on them before he's going to put them into that kind of situation. So it is what he's doing, but the way he does it is through this incremental approach and exposing them to a wide variety of difficulties that they have to struggle through and see God's faithfulness through it.
Okay. Were the Philistines subservient to the Egyptians this time?
It's not clear. At least I don't know for sure. And I don't think the historians know for sure, but I may be wrong on that. There's a lot of debate about whether the Philistines were placed there by the Egyptians and whether they were subservient to the Egyptians. I don't know.
I'm just wondering about when he says that and the Egyptians know that I am the Lord. There was that weird thing they had about the domain of their gods. I mean, like on this side of the river, our God rules. That side of the river, their God rules. Until our God kicks their God's fan, we can't go over there because that's not his domain. I'm wondering if maybe they left the Egyptian domain and their God still kicked on the Egyptian top. It's not part of what was going on. The Egyptians themselves had to know that the Israelites' God was not limited by where the Israelites were or had been or the borders of the nations. It was God as God of the period. Mm-hmm. That may have been something that had to happen.
I think that is something that God does over time show the Israelites. I think that's true. Margaret?
Kevin's remark about God it sort of in connection with your explanation of God doing things in certain ways, gradually, the way we experience change is an accumulation kind of thing. It seems possible to me that although it sounds like the God hardening Pharaoh's heart was an instantaneous flipping of a switch, that might just be an expression of the way it looked from an outside observer, but in fact, God set this up in creating Pharaoh the way he was and giving him particular experiences just the same way as he was schooling the Israelites' hearts, creating them to be what he wanted them to be. It was just that we see the effects of the hardening. It also says Pharaoh hardened his heart too, and it's simultaneously true. So just because we see all of a sudden an apparent change of heart doesn't mean God flipped a switch. It could have been very gradual.
Right.
In fact, I think it's probably likely just the same accumulation of experiences as with everybody else.
Right. And that we can identify with what happened to Pharaoh. That is, we've had experiences where we did something and then you begin to regret it. You think, oh, I made a mistake there. I shouldn't have let him go. I shouldn't have bought that house. I shouldn't have bought that car. That kind of thing. That regret that comes afterwards, we can identify with that. I think what generally when I read about God, the Old Testament descriptions of God hardening someone's heart, or I can always identify with the psychology that was going on there. I've had experiences that I can identify with that thing. So I think we should assume that God was working through the same means in affecting people's lives back then as he does now, that he didn't break the rules of human psychology in order to do it. We need to stop.